Now, the voices of Bronco Athletics, Bob Beeler and Chris Lewis on Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM, The Ticket.
We're going to spend some time today talking about coaching. Who and what are good tournament coaches? And then also, in about 10, 15 minutes, we're going to take a look at where the coaching hires are going, where you can go to make that home run that can get your team into the Sweet 16 where we are playing this weekend. Chris, I think good tournament coachings may be the chicken and the egg theory. What comes first? Do you got to be a good tournament coach by winning some games, and then all of a sudden, oh, he's won a couple tournament games, he's got to be a good tournament coach? Or are there things that make you a good tournament coach that allow you to advance? Because one of the guys that I know you know well, Jim Boeheim, was thought of as a very poor tournament coach until he won his national championship. And then it's amazing what the perception of Jim Boeheim was. Was he a better coach when he lost games early in the tournament to like the 15 seed Richmond? Was he a better coach when he won tournament games in advance to win a championship? My guess is that Jim Boeheim was Jim Boeheim, and he was just fortunate to have won in some years and lost in others.
It sounds like you don't think there's such thing as good tournament coaches, and it's all a media myth. It's all just built up. Am I putting words in your mouth?
No, I think it's overrated. I think if you have the right year, you get somebody in the right frame, you've got the right players. I mean, I think players, somebody making the shot that you need to make to advance is more important than a coach coming up with certain strategies.
Yeah, I will take it a step further and give you no room for error, no doubt, no nothing like that. There is no such thing as good and bad tournament coaches. There's no such thing as he's a good tournament coach, he's not a good tournament coach. There's good and bad coaches, absolutely. There's coaches that put themselves in position to be in the NCAA tournament. There's coaches that build up great programs. There's coaches that don't. There's coaches that are incompetent. There's coaches that don't draw up good plays. There's good coaches. There's bad coaches. But what makes him a good and a bad coach doesn't suddenly change when it's a single elimination format. Our perception is generally based on how you do early in your tournament career as a coach. You brought up Jim Boeheim. He had some hiccups, but then later on he had some success. But what you do, allow your first impression is your lasting impression, right? Like whatever your first impression was, it's hard for it's hard for it to be changed in our minds. And I think a lot of that has to do with coaching, but it's almost a statistical thing. You know, the more you get there, the more your results will be evenly distributed based on where your seeding should be. Like, the more you get the opportunity to be a 1 and 2 seed, you'll have some runs where you go deep. You'll have some runs where you get tripped up along the way. You don't maximize your seeding. And the more chances that you have, it's like a general statistics plot that you had back in your high school statistics class. The more chances that you have, the probability evens out to where, yeah, it'll probably even out general to where your seed line is. If you're a 3 seed a bunch of times, you'll have times where you make it to the Elite Eight. You'll have some times where you make it to the Final Four. You'll have some times where you don't get out of the first round. That's just the way it is. So the more you get there, the more we'll see you vary your results. But how you do early in your career, that's typically what we'll have our perception based on. And I can point to any coach in college basketball and give you a 3-year span of bad tournament results. Any coach, any. You can pick whatever you think is the best tournament coach that you can come up in your mind, and whoever you think is the worst, I can maybe come up with a couple of year span where they exceeded their seeding marks. So I'll play this game. Tom Izzo, right?
You'd say bad.
Yeah, but that's somebody who you generally
think. I know.
Because a lot of it early in his career, he exceeded the expectation. Right. But it seems like the more you get there, the more evenly distributed right. The results are. The
water finds its level.
The last 3 years, it's only been no Sweet 16 appearances, losing as a 2 to a 15 to Middle Tennessee State. This year, losing to an 11 as a 3. The year before, as an 8-9 matchup. I forget what seed they were. They won that, but they ended up losing to the 1 seed. They haven't been in a Sweet 16 with Izzo and Michigan State in 3 years now. If that was the first 3 years of his coaching tenure at Michigan State, I bet you our perception would be, this guy can't coach in the tournament.
And at a school like that, he might even be out because Michigan State, if it's the person following Tom Izzo, they might say, well, we got this guy, he just can't get us down the line.
Yeah.
When I look at this field, I got a couple of things, Chris. I'll have an answer, and I'd like an answer from you. 16 teams left. Who, if they win a national championship, helps their resume the most? I've got Matt Painter in Purdue. I think a lot of people don't even know who he is that coaches. He took over. It was basically a coach in waiting for Gene Katie. Purdue is usually a redheaded stepchild in the Big Ten. They're a team that, in most sports in the Big Ten, don't finish in the top of the pack. If he's able to come up with the national championship, to me, I think he could do more to help his resume. I mean, if Calipari or Boeheim get another one, I don't think their resume looks that much different. Same thing with Mike Krzyzewski at Duke, or some of the other blue blood coaches that are out here. He, for me, is the guy that if he wins, I think can do the most for his resume, because I think at Purdue he's probably not going anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, that's a different discussion than a good or a bad tournament coach, like who could help their reputation the most, and that's just kind of how you're seeing then. I mean, I would think Mark Few is generally the answer. It's a good answer to this question. If you win a championship, now we frame your, you know, he's already thought of as a great coach, mm-hmm. So I mean, maybe it doesn't matter, but I do.
But maybe he elevates to the next, to the blue blood level.
Exactly. So that's kind of where I would go with that, but I could make the case for a lot of different people. Eric Musselman, you know, if he does his little stick all the way to a championship, that certainly takes him into a whole different stratosphere. You know, Bob Huggins is one that name, he doesn't come up very much, but with West Virginia, he's been to a couple of Final Fours, one with West Virginia, one with Cincinnati. But if he goes and takes a championship run, I mean, is he looked at differently? So there's a lot of those good to great type ones. And Matt Painter might be a little bit more off the radar than some of them. And he certainly has a team, although, you know, the injury to was a Haas, who their big 7-foot-1 guy, who
I think makes it more difficult.
Yeah, it probably makes the path a little bit more challenging for him.
To me, the guy that I've seen, and maybe because I've called his games and dealt with him at three different schools, not the last one that he's at, but John Beilein is a guy that, to me, has built his career starting as a community college head coach. He's one of seven to take four teams to the NCAA tournament. And he's been a guy that, you know, has been viewed as a good coach at Canisius, Richmond, West Virginia, and Michigan. Mm. He could probably help his resume by getting to a Final Four for the first time, and then who knows if Michigan can cut it down. I don't think he has the team to go all the way this year, although his half of the draw probably a little more friendly than the other half of the draw, which is left.
Now, like, again, being a good coach, I think, is a thing. And a lot of these guys with a title, it can put them in a different tier as in, like, good coach or great coach. Does it put them in a different tier of a great tournament coach? No, because next year they could go out here. Like, what is it? The defending champions haven't made the Sweet 16 like 8 of the last 9 years or something like that. So, like, well, that tells you a stat right there that, well, okay, if there was such a great tournament coach the year before, they suddenly forgot everything they knew.
But how much of that roster is the same? I'll bet you not much of the roster is the same. So the fact that somebody wins a national championship, you're probably going to have some seniors on that roster if you win. You're probably also going to maybe have some one-and-dones. So either
you could
way,
have some freshmen and they won't be back
next
year.
But I'm saying, if you look at the lineup of who's on a team in a given championship year, very rarely does that team come back intact. There might be a couple of starters. So I don't know that you have, you know, people like Duke when you had Hill and Leitner and Hurley and those guys on there where, you know, you conceivably could see somebody win 3 or 4 in a row.
Your great coaching is your ability to amass that talent and put yourself in a position to be back in. But, again, if we're crediting the coach a lot of the times for these runs, when if you're saying, well, if they didn't have the good players, they didn't make the run, well, then maybe some credit should go to the players in that same aspect too. So, yeah, even Coach K, like I look at him, 2005 to 2009, he underachieved in the tournament, out here losing to Lehigh. And have any deep runs. I mean, like, seriously, can't come up with a coach who doesn't have a 3 or 4 year span where if that was the first 4 years of their coaching career, you would say they were trash in the tournament.
Right.
So I don't even buy, like, there's good coaches, and that's maybe the fun discussion that we're kind of having of, you know, Matt Painter can be in a different tier of just being a good general coach if we were to have a Final Four run or a championship run. You know, but it's not going to change his perception.
What I would love to ask is for some of these coaches what their ardent fan base thinks of them. Hmm. Because I'm guessing that maybe there are some of these guys that maybe are thought of better nationally than they are in their own backyard and vice versa.
Like Michigan State fans, you read their message boards, they're turning on Izzo a little bit. Like they are, and especially with all the other things that are going on in Michigan State, that probably doesn't have to do with basketball. And, you know, he's gotten a lot of heat this year and maybe didn't give satisfactory answers to some questions at some press conferences this year. But yeah, even Tom Izzo, who, and I do think a lot of this is who are the guys in power in the media, and largely the coach's relationship with those opinion shapers in the media is what fuels our perception. Because, you know, there are guys like Coach K who are well-connected to all the media guys. So it's generally going to be nice things said about him by Dick Vitale on the broadcast. And that fuels your perception of them as a coach. So I do think media relationships and the opinion shakers' relationships with these head coaches, that does matter in how we perceive them.
Time is money. And if you've got the time, we've got the money. Your chance to win $1,000 four times a day, 4K a day, on Sports Radio The Ticket is coming up soon. Up next, coaching changes. Looks like it might be a quiet year for college basketball. We'll take a look at the decisions made, where the coaches have come from in this year's Sweet 16, and how football coaching decisions and basketball coaching decisions are similar and different. That's next on Sports Radio The Ticket. Back on Idaho Sports Talk, NCAA tournament games coming up tomorrow, some press conferences going on today for the Thursday games. Of course, you can hear it right here on Sports Radio The Ticket. We get to the Sweet 16, and maybe some of it now is because so many players are either one and done, or you really don't get to know them the way we got to know them in college basketball, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So much more, and I think it always has been a coach's sport. You can see them on the sidelines orchestrating, directing traffic. But this is the time of the year when coaching jobs are open and winning a game at the right time, Chris, can lead you to that next job. Mm-hmm. And I look at the difference between basketball and football. Odom, that was the coach at UMBC, wins that game and all of a sudden could find himself on some lists where if they don't win the game against Vermont and the game against Virginia, his resume stays at the bottom of the pile and he never gets considered. One game in basketball makes much difference than one game in football, because no one's going to ever hire somebody if their team went 6-6 and they had a bowl win.
So do you think that's a good thing for basketball or a bad thing?
I think it's bad for the teams doing the hiring. I think it's good for the coach if he gets, you know, that one shining moment that they like, and all of a sudden you get this big contract offer because you've gotten your team to the second round of the NCAA tournament. Mm. But I think you got to let the resume speak for itself and look at what somebody has done over the years. And if what they've done to build up to where they are isn't worthy of where you are on your what you're looking for job experience-wise, I don't think you hire that person.
Yeah, I mean, the Chris Peterson bowl game that he won against Oklahoma, isn't that like as close as you can get with like one game putting you
on
the
map? But he was undefeated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not like UMBC didn't have a good season. Like,
they were
a pretty good team. They made the run. They won their conference tournament. That's kind of like winning your conference in football in a way, right? So it's not like they had a bad season. They had a pretty good season. And the one game put him on the map. And I'm not saying just one game put Chris Peterson on the map, and it certainly didn't want to leave Boise State after that one game against Oklahoma. But, like, is that not a similar situation?
That one game vaulted him from being somebody that probably most people could not have recognized or named to somebody who was viewed as a certainly an up-and-comer in the business of college football. I kind of break down into four categories of where you can look for your coach. You can look for an assistant, whether that be with your team or whether you're going to lure an assistant to come over. Somebody that's up and coming, and sometimes that could be at a bigger place or a smaller place, but somebody that's at a smaller place than where you are. A blue blood, which means you're stealing them by paying money to hire them away, somebody at a similar level. I would put Roy Williams going from Kansas to North Carolina as a blue blood hire. Urban Meyer, Florida to Ohio State, a blue blood hire, even though Urban was out for a year. Somebody coming on the downside, and I would put Georgia's hire of Tom Crean, somebody who was fired on the downside, hired as a coach, and then sometimes somebody coming from the pros, usually speaking, somebody that was not successful in the pros, Eric Musselman would fall into that category.
So of those, you gave the four, the list of four, your program. What is the order of operations for the attempt of, okay, if you go with this option first, if this option's not available, then you go with this. Like, what's the order for you?
I think I would hire somebody on an up-and-come, somebody that's been a head coach at a place that's done well and looks like they have a long track record of running a good program, somebody that is consistently good. If you look at Boise State's most recent hire for basketball, they looked at who is the best team around here, similar to Boise State, and Gonzaga and Mark Few popped up. They went and hired the top assistant in Coach Rice. So that was the where they look, which is another good way to do it. But if you're asking me, more times than not, a lot of times there is that right fit, somebody that you feel will come in, do something with your culture, and be the right choice. Like Tom Izzo moved up as an assistant. He was an assistant at Michigan State. Duke saw something in a little-known head coach at Army and plucked Mike Krzyzewski. Now, both of those guys were given a lot of time to be head coach. But I think if you're giving me, in basketball, one choice, and I have to look in that category only, I'm going to take somebody that has built a program where they are, and you're taking them, hopefully making a carbon copy of what they've done further down the line at your place.
Almost like the Brad Stevens, like the up-and-comer at Butler. And instead of him going to a different college, he took an NBA job to kind of put two and two together. That's the best way to turn yourself into a good tournament coach. You have a good run, then you leave the tournament and never come back, so you don't have your bad tournament results in there.
But just for this year, just to give people an idea, this year's Sweet 16, there are two people who were assistants, eight that came from smaller programs moving up, two which were blue bloods stealing from another team at the same level you are, two that were head coaches moving down, and two were failed coaches in the pros. And the top four seeds, if you want to look at it, figure maybe the deck is a little different. Those are the teams that did it during the regular season. Also two from assistants, 11 from smaller up-and-comers, one blue blood, and two head coaches that moved down.
There you go. So it's a... You learn a little bit by at least looking at the top teams. I think that's probably the more telling is, you know, who are the established coaches, and that's usually the top four seeds, and you can learn are the top two seeds. You probably learn a little bit more from doing that. At least to me, from gathering the different hires that some of these programs have made the last few years, I feel like college basketball coaching hires have become kind of like political elections in a way, where outsiders are in. Like, the more experience you have in a game, at least to me, it seems like the perception is the more corrupt you are, especially with the college basketball and the way it is now. And in a way, people want somebody who hasn't had anything to do with college basketball for the last few years, whether 5 years, 10 years, whatsoever, them to come in, drain the swamp, if you will, and kind of have the fresh perspective. I'm looking at some of the big hires who were outsiders to the game of college basketball within the last few years. Might not be outsiders to the given schools that they got hired by, like St. John's hiring Chris Mullin. Like, that's getting somebody who can rally the base, if you will, because he's a legend at the school. But he's had nothing to do with college basketball before he was hired at St. John's for like 10 to 15 years before he was brought aboard. Georgetown, they hired Patrick Ewing. Again, somebody, former player there, can rally a lot of the support. But he had nothing to do with college basketball for 20 years before he took that job. Memphis, the hire they just made, and Penny Hardaway. Penny Hardaway, one of Memphis's best players. But he had nothing to do with college basketball over the last 15 years. And now he's the head coach at Memphis. Even UConn, when they decided to bring in Kevin Ollie. Like, Kevin Ollie was somebody who wasn't some mainstay in college basketball who worked his way up the assistant ranks. He was an NBA assistant, an NBA player, and a former player at UConn. And now he just got dismissed, but he did win a championship there at UConn. So I do think there's something to be said for outsiders becoming a thing right now.
I don't know that I agree with you on the term outsiders. I think St. John's, Georgetown, and Memphis, and going with Mullen, Ewing, and Penny, are trying to reach back for past glories. Those guys were guys that led their teams to either the Final Four or a national championship. And I think they're going with guys that, when you look at those three, really didn't have a whole lot of collegiate coaching experience at all.
Yeah,
some of them didn't even have any coaching at all. Hardaway is coming from high school. Ewing was an NBA assistant.
Mullen was, what, in the front office with Golden State? Really didn't do all that well. But I think the common denominator with those three is those guys were superstars when they were at their schools. And I think the schools are trying to rekindle something that happened when they were there.
I mean, they rally the base. They're not outsiders to the school. They're absolutely, like, connected to their school. But they're not connected to the ins and outs of college basketball right now. And I think there's something to be said for not wanting somebody who is in the middle of the college basketball and the way college basketball currently is perceived in 2018, of it being kind of dirty, kind of slimy. If you could get somebody who's not associated with that, kind of like politics, if you could get somebody who's not associated with the dirty goings of politics, somebody from the outside, and then they can come in, they might not be, like, not known to people, like, you know, Donald Trump was certainly known to people, but he's an outsider in the game of politics, and now he's the president.
But you think that they hired Mullen, Ewing, and I mean, Penny Hardaway, to me, just from what I've read, sounds like a backstabber. I mean, he basically fired Tubby Smith. He rallied people to push the coach out and put himself in. I would say that sounds slimy to me.
I mean, that's not good. That's political. That's very political. And maybe that shows he got what it takes to be a good coach. I don't know. With Penny Hardaway, I mean, you could also make the case that he's connected to the shoe companies, too, with the AAU program.
Yeah, and, which, like, is pretty slimy.
And right now, that's not exactly what you want. But he also hasn't been a college assistant coach. And, you know, given the FBI investigation and everything that has to do with some of these, you know, assistant coaches throughout the country, I can understand these programs. Hey, if we can come up with an option that can win the press conference, somebody who's been a legend at our school and isn't in the day-to-day workings of what's the mess in college basketball right now, I see why that's an attractive choice.
Three hope openings in the Mountain West. None have been filled yet. Colorado State and Utah State's openings by firing. Fresno State's left Rodney Terry taking the job at UTEP. Seems to me, at least right now, Chris, this has been a quiet year for coaching changes in college basketball. Best job out there is Louisville. David Padgett, the interim's not returning. Pitt and UConn are out there, but not a lot of Power 5 jobs out there.
Wait until that FBI investigation reaches another, turns the page once again. I mean, that FBI thing ain't going down anytime soon. So once that starts to get more well known, it might be a different timeline for some of these openings, but I have a feeling we'll have some turnaround throughout this offseason and maybe into next season, given the results of the FBI investigation.
And I think when you look at some of the teams that have made it to the Sweet 16, it encourages coaching turnover. Nevada had three straight losing seasons. They make a change. They pick the right guy, Musselman. He has them in the Sweet 16 in the third year. They were in the NCAA tournament in the second year. Chris Beard, in his second year at Texas Tech, taking over from Tubby Smith, who was let go at Texas Tech. Brad Brownell is somebody, I had to look at his background at Clemson. He came from North Carolina, Wilmington, and Wright State. Now, he's been there 5 or 6 years, but he has Clemson now among the upper echelon teams in the ACC. So I think when you see what some of these guys are doing and where the teams have come from, I think it does encourage some teams to make moves, make changes, and we'll see if it ends up, you know, turning the wheel a couple more times. But right now, unless, you know, Louisville, Pitt, and UConn take people, I guess Dan Hurley right now, the most hot commodity as far as the name. He was the head coach, or is the head coach, at Rhode Island right now.
Ticket sports update sponsored by Wendy's. Wendy's serves fresh beef on every hamburger every day. Download the Wendy's app for offers you can't find anywhere else. Well, we'll start this ticket sports update with a quick Boise State note. Allison Sang was named the Mountain West Softball Player of the Week last week for the Broncos. Broncos went 5-0 last week, including a 3-0 start in conference play, with Sang leading the way, going 12-15 from the plate. So another season in the Mountain West, another Player of the Week for Boise State. The trend seems to continue. Well, Nevada will look to make school history tomorrow, advancing to the Elite Eight for the first time in school history. Today, the team had a press conference, and the players, mainly Halsey Cook, talked about making sure the Wolfpack get off to a fast start this time against Loyola and don't have to come from a double-digit hole for the third time in three games in March Madness.
Just coming out and executing offensively, getting everybody the ball and involved early, just getting a feel for it. And then defensively, that helps us, you know, talk and communicate, and everybody feels like they have a groove. I believe, like, if we get behind with this team, it'll be hard to get back in front because they execute so well offensively. You know how to control the pace of the game. So it's very important for us to get out to a good start, crash the offensive glass, and, you know, take our time offensively and get great shots.
Sometimes maybe you want to stay behind. Not that you want to be behind by 22. I'll remember my last year at UMass. Played five games in the NIT. We were behind at half, four ahead, one. And the one that we were ahead, we lost. So sometimes you don't. But I think you play with fire if you keep getting down double figures in the second half.
Yeah, similar to what, like, you know, Coach Rice, I was always wondering, okay, what does he have up his sleeve next in terms of a stunt that could top the previous one for a sellout? I wonder if Nevada wins. Like, what does Coach Musselman have left up his sleeve to, like, do after the game? Like, I feel like he's already celebrated, like, they've made the Final Four, and they're only at the Sweet 16 level. And what can he do next? Like, he's already taken off his shirt.
Streak?
Do you want to see
that? No, I don't want to see that. I'm just saying, I mean, if you're going to go bigger and bigger, right?
I mean, that's what the next gradual step is, I suppose.
Climb up on top of the backboard and sit up there?
I mean, you got to cut down the nets at some point if you reach the Final Four. So maybe he, instead of cutting down the nets, he just, like, sits on the net and doesn't leave. I don't know. He's got something, though. He has to.
Well, probably the most Googled phrase today in Alabama is thumb injury. That's because the most talked about quarter battle this spring in college football has been put on hold. Alabama started spring ball yesterday, and sophomore Tua Tagovailoa will miss a few days of practice after injuring his hand in the first practice. And this is what Nick Saban had to say today about the injury to his star sophomore quarterback.
Tua, you know, hurt his thumb today in practice, taking him to Birmingham to get that evaluated. But, you know, probably going to require some time for him to get back. And I don't want to speculate on what the injury might be. Most of the time when these type things happen, It takes a little while for him to come back. Well, I mean, Tua, obviously, I think in a few days, Tua would probably be able to do some things. But when you hurt your thumb on your throwing hand, it's kind of hard to grip the ball. So I think that's going to be the issue, is whether he's able to throw it. He and Jaden were splitting reps. And, you know, we're giving both guys an opportunity and see how they compete and see how they do. So we don't have any decisions. We're not speculating on any decisions, but we're just going to be fair and honest in terms of how we give both players a chance to compete.
I'm almost speechless listening to that. I never thought Nick Saban would give a real honest answer of an evaluation of an injury. Now, I know it's spring and it's not during the season, but can you imagine that question, A, being asked and B, being answered on a game week?
Not a chance. Not a chance. He goes that we're going to Birmingham. He's even telling the location. Mm-hmm. Going to Birmingham to get it looked at, and it's going to require. It'd be, if he's available, he's available. If he's not, he's not. Yeah. We're getting ready for our next
opponent. Are you saying? What did you hear? Because no one would have heard about it probably in the regular season.
Exactly. So, yeah, maybe this is the most analyzed thumb since, was it, didn't Tom Brady injure his thumb in the playoffs last year, or going into the playoffs? So Nick Saban and Bill Belichick can never separate them too much.
But I mean, that's why you know, you don't want to push one of them out the door yet.
Yeah, absolutely. You have keep your options while you have them.
Well, one bad news about options for Alabama is right now they don't have an option at third quarterback. They missed out on recruiting one, and they've now lost what was expected to be a grad transfer, Gardner Minshew, who had announced last week he was intending to go to the Tide from East Carolina, announced on Twitter yesterday that he will now instead transfer to Washington State. Interesting part of this story, according to ESPN, a source close to Minshew said he only announced his intention to transfer to Alabama to draw attention from other school and never had any never planned on attending Alabama at all.
Well, why would you? You've got two quarterbacks that are pretty good. To me, if you're this guy from East Carolina and your goal is to play, wouldn't you want to find a spot that would have an opening?
I thought the Washington State backup quarterback was better than Luke Falk against Boise State. Wasn't it? Like, he was better against Boise State, the Washington State backup, so you're going to have a tougher competition there.
It was the kid that...
Yeah, Chris. Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I forgot about that. Oh, I'm so sorry about that. That mistake. I just completely forgot about that. Rest in peace to him. It's my mistake that I forgot about it.
Well, the American Flag Football League is having their U.S. Open of football, and they've added a Heisman-winning trophy winner to their roster. It was announced today that Danny Werfel will captain one of the pro teams that will participate in the Pros vs. Joes Championship. Werfel also had Florida announce today that he is looking to have open tryouts at the team facility for up to five former Gators to join his team. So now they have a Heisman trophy winner playing flag football.
What do you think? I mean, I guess he could probably still throw it. Probably doesn't have to run much.
I mean, there's nothing more exciting than Michael Vick playing flag football. So, yeah. If Michael Vick loses to Danny Werfel, I think
But Michael Vick, it can, in my opinion, at least if their skills are still somewhat comparable with the skills they played pro football with, I could see Michael Vick taking off and running and spinning and twirling and not allowing you to grab the flag. I don't know that I think Danny Werfel's going to have to sit in the pocket.
Yeah, well, Michael Vick, watching him play flag football will still be, you know, pretty – I still think that's, like, the ultimate. And don't they still have that competition for, like, regular people to get a chance to play against
Werfel
Michael Vick?
Yeah, Werfel will play on the pro side, and then that pro – there's four pro teams that will compete to play the Joe's winner.
So everybody on Werfel's team is technically going to be a pro? Or,
yeah, or former – for some sort of former athlete.
So, again, I guess that would be interesting. I think it'd be kind of fun to play. You know, if we had a team here, you know, sometimes you can go out and hire somebody that could be a ringer, right? If you had like a team, you know.
Yeah, we got to find the guy who can lift the amateur team, the ringer of – can we search our NFL contacts? Like, you know, even your former Boise State players. Like, what former Boise State player could we find to help us out in a flag football competition? Because Fish out here apparently is a flag football like guy. Like, he's out here playing.
I try.
Okay, so what position is the most valuable?
Quarterback, 100%.
And that's your position, right?
Sometimes.
So we want to find somebody to replace
him. Yeah, we need to find maybe a Jared Zabransky can take some time off from selling real estate. He can be our ringer. Mm-hmm. No one's heard of him, right?
It's not like he's played in any big games.
Not in this town. Everybody's heard of him. I mean, what do you have? Jared on one team. Taylor Tharp's around, right? You could get Taylor on another team. I'm trying to think of what other former quarterbacks are here. We could maybe.
But with flag football, you need a runner, right? Like, that's the thing about flag football. And because when they rush, you can then take off.
Yeah, but I mean, if they can get the ball out quick enough, rush doesn't matter.
Because put it this way, if you got nobody to throw the ball to, what good is a quarterback? The quarterback needs to be able to run if you got no receivers, a la Michael Vick in the early 2000s.
Based off what I've seen on Caves and Prater, our offensive line should be pretty good. Should be pretty hard to get around.
Are you calling them fat?
I'm telling them they'd be good offensive linemen.
You're calling
them
fat.
But if we have all six of us, I might be another good offensive lineman. So, well, we might have a good line, but I don't know what we have in the way of playmakers.
I could get a jump ball. Throw it up there.
There you go. We got one good receiver and a great offensive line.
All right. Well, we'll see. March Madness will start up again tomorrow night, and you can hear it here on Sports Radio, The Ticket. Tune in to AM 1350 tomorrow at 5 for Loyola against Nevada, and then Friday at 5 for Clemson and Kansas. 93.1 FM will join in progress for the rest of the evening at 6, both Thursday, which is tomorrow, and Friday. March Madness on Sports Radio, The Ticket will tip off again this weekend starting tomorrow. Coming up next in Quick Hits, what might the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim be doing that no one would think they would do? And what other sporting event could get the NFL draft treatment? That's next on Sports Radio, The Ticket.
Quick Hits with Bob and Chris. Topic number one.
All right, Chris, what other sporting events could get the NFL draft treatment?
I don't think any. And that's the crazy thing. Like, the NFL draft has suddenly become like the TV superstar event. All of a sudden, ESPN, and they're going to simulcast later parts of the draft on ABC. So they're going to have two different networks showing it. Now, NFL Network is having a simulcast on Fox for you to be able to see the draft on Fox. So there's like four different channels where you can see the reading of names. You hate the draft because that's what you just think it is. It's a reading of names, and you're like, just give me the list. I don't need the analysis. Just give me a list of players who are taken. And I like it more than you do, but four networks having the draft is crazy. I don't think there's any other sporting event that would ever have four networks televising it.
Well, first of all, most of the times they can keep others out. I don't know why they would allow, you know, the first Super Bowl, there were two networks that did it, both CBS and NBC did it. The only thing, when I think of multiple things covering something that's sort of an event, would be like the Rose Parade or the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade. Because it's on the street, they can't stop you from televising it if you want to televise it. So that's why on the Rose Parade, you'll see three or four networks doing that every New Year's Day. I guess it's easy programming. It's probably something that I don't know if anybody pays any money to televise. Maybe yes, maybe no. But, you know, I don't know that you'd ever see, okay, CBS is going to have their broadcast of I guess the closest thing is the Homer cast that they have on the championship games or the Final Four, where you know TNT will run the one slanted towards Team A, and
they gave that
TBA,
up though, right? They don't do that anymore.
They don't. Okay, well they did it at one point, you know, and now you see the coaches. The game with the coaches sitting there and having the high 12,
yeah,
high
sure.
11 or something. But it's basically all by the same company that's doing it,
mm-hmm.
the one that has the rights to the given games. This one, to me, would be very different because the last time I looked, Fox and the ESPN/ABC, NFL Network, sort of, all competitors.
Now, ESPN apparently is owning the regional Foxes. The whole media ownership landscape is becoming a very complicated thing. I think the closest comparison might be the political conventions, right? Like, you know,
they let them all, but I think they view it as news. I think that's how they get around it. I don't think the Republicans or the Democrats are selling rights fees for somebody to get their stuff. I think they probably want to be on as many networks as possible to get their message across.
Topic number two.
What former NFL player has mixed a passion with a business opportunity?
Well, it's Ricky Williams. If you remember him, the Heisman Trophy winning running back at Texas. Mike Ditka traded a whole bunch of draft picks to get him for the Saints. Then he went on to play the Dolphins. Suspended multiple times for testing positive for marijuana. He is going to run Real Wellness by Ricky Williams. It's going to be a cannabis-based wellness brand. It's going to be available at dispensaries in California. He says it's a dream come true, saying that it has always been an important part of his healing journey.
I mean, I don't even know what the reaction is. That the least surprising news of the day? It's Ricky Williams.
I just thought if there's somebody that's going to do it, you know, guess who's going to do it, just like maybe somebody would open a restaurant or somebody would, you know, buy a car dealership, you know, post-football years and actually work at something. Some get into the broadcast business. Team Ricky Williams.
Topic number three.
Do you think LeBron's voice matters to the NBA office?
I think it does. And the fact that LeBron just called their play-in idea whack, I think will kind of resonate. Because you don't want LeBron calling your idea a silly one and then just go with it anyway. And that's what he said about the whole play-in 7 versus 10 seed, 8 versus 9 for the last two playoff slots. LeBron just says keep it the way it is. Now, should you make decisions solely based on LeBron? Probably not. But should he have an impact on your decision? And if he's publicly willing to say your idea is whack, should you maybe reconsider it? Absolutely.
He's a big NBA fan. Do you like a play-in for the last spots or not?
I think the top 8 works. I don't know what the play-in accomplishes. Like the single elimination, I think it actually devalues the regular season. It becomes more like the baseball thing where it's like, well, if I'm 8 games better than you in the wild card standings, why is the only thing I have home field advantage in a 1-game playoff for a slot in? That, to me, is flawed. I don't know why you would want something like that.
Topic number 4.
What tough decision might the Angels have to make with their roster this spring?
What to do with Shohei Ohtani? He was 2-for-24 hitting going into yesterday's game, hitting .083, but did get a hit. So now he's 3-for-28 hitting .107, that broke an 0-for-14 slump. He's been viewed by scouts as overmatched. Now, when they signed him, most scouts thought he was a better pitcher than a hitter, or at least further along in his development. But the pitching hasn't been great. Overall, if you count minor league games and B games, he has a 16.20 ERA, giving up 4 home runs in 8 1/3 innings, but does have 19 strikeouts. Fastball is hit 98. But if you throw out the minor league games and a game against a Mexican league team, in 2 2/3 innings against major league opposition, the opposing teams are hitting .529 against him and bashed 3 home runs. If you send him down and doesn't start the season and you hold him past, I think it's some date in May, you'll get an extra year of control for free agency. It will be interesting, but a lot of reasons why maybe Ohtani starts the year in the minors.
Yeah, I don't think you can do that. No, like given the attention and the hype and... I don't know if they sold many jerseys. I don't know the jersey sale numbers, but I mean, this was hyped to the max. He was the Babe Ruth of Japan, right? Babe Ruth. You don't start Babe Ruth in no minor leagues. So, but you were on the hook for this. You got to work out his struggles.
But sometimes it's tough to work it out at the major league level. I mean, anybody that's trying to battle for a roster spot that, you know, isn't a seasoned major leaguer, if you were hitting .107 and your ERA was 27, you wouldn't be making the team.
But it's also spring, right? Like, do we really base our entire roster spots off of spring if we thought you were good? That's the thing. Like, what is Buster Posey's average right now in spring training?
It was close to 500.
Okay, maybe it's a bad example. But what if he was 100?
Would you
he's still
going to be
concerned
about
Buster Posey for
no,
the season?
I would be concerned with him if he was injured and not getting in the game. That's where I would be concerned with him. But
you're right. If you think he's good, then you think he's good. And you clearly thought he was good to have that competitive negotiation to get him on your team.
We'll see how he does, in the first year. When we come back, Huddle Up with Harse. We do it every Wednesday. We'll hit some of the themes in spring with Harse next on Sports Radio The Ticket.
It's time to huddle up with Harse. Now, here's Boise State football coach Brian Harsin with Bob Beeler and Chris Lewis on Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM, The Ticket.
Today, we'll take a look at some of the comments from Coach Harsin this week about spring football. And, Chris, you made an interesting comment as we were getting ready for this show that spring football this year seems to be quieter than last year, in your opinion. And Chris has got the finger in front of the mouth saying,
"It's quiet, right?" I mean, I'm not just imagining this. Is this something you agree with? It seems like it's less of a focus / attention. There's fewer questions.
I think there's more back
less concern.
I think there's more back, and I think you're coming off a championship.
Yeah, I think that the quiet spring would mean that the Coach Harsin and the team and the rest of the coaching staff, they have the trust of the media and fans to where, you know, if last season was a year, another one in which Boise State did not win the Mountain or did not win the Mountain West Championship game, the microscope would be on. The focus would be there. What's wrong? Why not? Where's the battle? Who's emerging? Something need it. There needs to be something that changes. But it's not that. You're coming off of a championship. You won the Mountain West. You won the Mountain Division. Beat Fresno State in the championship game to win it, and you dominated the bowl game. So, like any relationship, if every detail doesn't have to be a loud, contentious argument, it means that there's trust in the relationship. And it seems like, at least from my perspective, and I don't want to speak for everybody because I'm sure the expectations for some people are even higher than winning the Mountain West Championship game and winning the Las Vegas Bowl. But at least from my perspective, I do think the quieter spring is more content fan base for what last season was.
And I think you're spot on in the sense that, you know, you look at every year, there's going to be a few openings. This year there's quite a few guys back, especially on the defensive side of the ball. Basically, Van Der Esch is the key guy that's being lost, and he's coming out early. You could have had everybody back if he decided to stay. So I think that, to me, people trust this coaching staff that, you know, we're going to coach people up, or they're going to find people, they're going to play at the various positions. Not that I have a couple positions that we'll get some comments from Coach Harsin about, and Coach Riddle, it's a position coach at tight end. Like, I've got three that I think are important that I'm going to be watching, but I don't think anybody that I've talked to has a doubt that they'll find somebody at these positions to play well.
Indeed, because I even think people learn from last year in terms of what was our conversation last year around this time, spring football, strengths, weaknesses, and like key players. And a lot of it just like had no bearing or just wasn't accurate, or the coaches solved it when it came to the season. Like last spring, we thought the defense was a weakness. Like, right, that was the area that had a question.
Well, it certainly was inexperienced.
Yeah,
it was going to be young.
We thought that would be the offense would be there. You got Rippon, you got Wilson.
And the first four games or so was the opposite.
Exactly. It was the defense was solid money. You can move the ball up and down the field on this Boise State defense. And the offense, who we thought was the reliable aspect, the next thing I wrote down, that Rippon was the unquestioned quarterback. Like, that was what we thought going into last spring. And you know, when the season arrived, that wasn't exactly the case. The backups last spring, Constantine and Reisdorf, there was no Montel Cozart, you know, and he ended up being a huge story on the season and was a problem solved by the coaches of having somebody behind Rippon who could do some different things to help spark the offense. And, you know, they ended up solving that issue. And I think one of the main takeaways we got last year, Velasquez, we're looking at him. Hey, you're the only kicker punter around here, right? You got to make sure he's up for the challenge. And it turns out, well, even if he wasn't ready for the moment, they had other guys who just came up and in fall showed that what they were all about. So why be worried? Why invest the
brain power to be concerned slash worried and do that to yourself, knowing that coaches will probably find a way around any issue that you might think is there.
All right, I got three position groups that I'm going to work, I don't want to say worry about, that I'm going to pay attention to this spring. I'm going to start with receivers. You lose Cedric Wilson. He's going to be an NFL draft pick. That's 83 catches, over 1,500 yards. You lost Spurbeck the year before when you had 2,000-yard receivers. Monster and Richardson combined for 65 catches. Evans and Thomas combined for 30. I think you're going to need to see all of those guys step up a little bit. You're going to need some new players to come in, but I'm going to look at receivers. And Coach Harsin at his press conference talked about the wide receivers, especially last year's guys that played as true freshmen, Evans and Thomas.
The thing about Octavius and CT, both those guys work extremely hard. They love football. Octavius is one of our hardest workers, and that goes in whatever drill, whether it's special teams, offense. We're out there in a team period. He's always challenging himself to go hard. He's a great effort guy, and he's got skill on top of that. So you're adding effort and technique together. He's going to go out there and make plays. CT's the same way. We're moving him around a little bit, and he's out there. I thought today he caught the ball well, made plays. He understands our system better. And, you know, CT and Octavius, both of those guys are able to play faster because they know the calls. We call a certain route, they know what to do and the details of it. So they're just playing faster, and it's showing up.
And I think they will be helped. Not that they did a whole lot last year, combining for 30 catches, 252 yards, and two touchdowns between the guys. But the fact that they've played, they've taken the field, they have an idea about the speed of the game, I think they will be further ahead than if they had redshirted. So I think that will come back. Next position group I have, Chris, is tight ends. You lose Jake Rowe, who was the second leading receiver behind Wilson. And you lose Alec Danans, who was a very good blocker, caught an occasional pass inside the red zone. And I always find it interesting when a coach singles somebody out before you even go to questions. And at this press conference, it was Matt Pastone, one of the backup tight ends. They had five until Chase Blakely got hurt. He's coming back, only played in two games last year. John Bates looks the part, 6'6", 247. Pastone and a couple of freshmen, they like to use three and four tight ends in different sets, Chris. So I think tight end is going to be a position group that's going to bear watching in spring and in camp.
One thing I learned from being here, the amount of time that I have, when the tight end position isn't catching passes, people here get upset. They just love tight end production. There were a couple of them years where the tight ends weren't producing, and like that was the thing that angered the fan base the most. Like, why can't the tight ends produce? And why aren't they getting the ball? Do they have the guys? So you're probably right about the position at least being one of intrigue.
And Kent Riddle talked about the tight ends and roles. I asked him, you know, if they've gotten guys that are like going to be the catching tight end like Rowe or maybe the blocking tight end like Danans, and this is what he had to say.
I think the one thing is this year, I think all those guys do all that stuff very well. So we haven't really established that. We've been kind of moving guys around, doing a lot of different stuff. Really expecting them all to do something rather than kind of putting them in roles at this point. So we'll figure that out when we get closer to game planning. But right now, very pleased with all of them.
And then the third position I have, center. Mason Hampton was all Mountain West, good blocker, line calls. Guys listed on the depth chart at center, Garrett Larson, who filled in a couple of games when Hampton was hurt, also started at other spots on the line. Dante Harrington, another backup. And this is what Coach Harsin had to say about the centers battling for that spot.
You know, Garrett's there. Garrett, Dante Harrington, those guys are playing that position. You know, as far as knowing what to do, that part of it, I feel confident. You know, they know what to do. They're getting different looks from the defense. It's challenging in the spring. You know, our D-line does a good job of mixing it up. The biggest key, you know, is snaps. It's being consistent. It's knowing the snap count. It's all the things before the ball is ever snapped that really those guys have to focus on, just like the quarterback position. You know, nothing starts until our center is on the ball, ready to go, and he actually snaps it. So there's a lot of things before the ball is in play that those guys have to do, and I think they're doing a good job of it.
Bob, you said battled, though.
Yeah.
You said guys battling for a position. Are you sure there's battles? There's no battles
here. There's no battles, that's right.
I'll have to change my opinion on that.
But Cleveland, Molchan, Cavedo all started last year. Larson did at some spot. Hampton gone, and then also Lewis gone. So there's really two openings at the center spot. I would think Larson's going to find his way in there for one of the two spots, maybe at center, but we'll see. Bulk of the line, got a lot of guys back with experience in the offensive line, although the center, to me, Hampton was very good and did a lot of things. So I think that's going to be a position that will help solidify the offensive line.
That was the position last year that I feel like it was the most, maybe for you too, of having to get the binoculars out in the pregame and seeing who's there. Like last year it just wasn't dependable on having the same five guys there from one game.
Oh, from
the
offensive line, yeah. They did a good job of mixing and matching. They had about six or seven they used, but you're right. On a given game, you know, was Hampton going to be able to go on this game? Oh, no. They've got Larson there, so that means they've got somebody else at left guard or somebody else at right guard. But they did a nice job.
Yeah, I mean, by the end, at the beginning of the year, it certainly was not what we would call a strength of the Boise State. And by the end of the year, it got there. So that's one of the things that is really hard to predict, where the injuries will be and how they'll be able to fill in the gaps when they arrive.
You know, looking at football, I think you are extremely fortunate if you are able to identify five guys to be in your offensive line and play them the entire season without having to have a change in the starting line. That's a tough position. I think that's hard to do.
Indeed. So that's why, even though there's no battles here, it'll be intriguing to watch the competition between the guys who can probably will all find a way if they're good enough to see the field at times, because that's just how it works with the shuffles with the offensive line.
And tomorrow again at this time, Chris, we're going to have Jason Horowitz from Westwood One. He's going to join us to talk about the tournament. So looking forward to that. And this week's sweet deal gets underway on Friday morning. You get 50% off the EuroShack at KTIK.com. The EuroShack offers authentic and unique takes on traditional Greek gyro in the freshest ingredients to be delivered at made-to-order pace. And today, as I mentioned a little earlier, the first time that I've ever had a gyro, and I was very pleased. Really liked the lamb. It was lean. It was tasty. So go to KTIK.com for a sweet deal valid at all eight locations. Sweet deal, again, begins Friday at 9 a.m. at KTIK.com. Again, $25 gets you $50 at the Euro Shack. Coming up next, Fish, we've got a fish tank. We haven't been swimming for a while. Maybe that's because the three of us haven't convened together in the same room in a while.
It's hard to go swimming when you're about 4,000 miles away from each other. But we'll go back to the fish tank. March Madness underway, but I've got a couple ways to improve it. Plus, we're going to look at fixing tanking in the NBA. That's all coming up next right here on Sports Radio, The Ticket.
It's the Fish Tank with Michael Fisher.
Producer of this show comes up with three topics. He really believes them at the bottom of his heart.
On Sports Radio, The Ticket.
That's right. It's time to come back into the Fish Tank now that everyone's here and everyone can sink and swim together as opposed to being across the country. And we'll start with March Madness, of course, been sweeping the nation. They'll get back in action with Sweet 16 tomorrow. But we need to make a change to the first four games first, and that is that the NCAA should remove first four games for non-16 seeds. There's two 16-seed games. There's two 11-seed games. And the 11 seeds, they get the advantage with the extra game. I did some checking. History says that 6 seeds win about 63% of the time. However, when there's been a play-in game, 11 seeds in that play-in games are 6-5 because they get that extra game. And if you need more proof, just look at Boise State the last couple years in the Mountain West Tournament. They've been the higher seed, but what happens? They lose to a team that had an extra game to get the jitters out. 1-11 seed in a play-in game one, and they're in the Sweet 16. That would be Chris's Syracuse. So, Chris, we'll start with you. Get rid of the play-in games except for the 16 seeds in the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, but on the Boise State example, why is Boise State seemingly the only team that loses that game? Usually the top seeds advance, unless it's been Boise State over the last few years. And it's so disappointing. Would like to see them reach that semifinal round. I'm going to sink this. It's funny because I remember you having the opinion, I think a year ago, that it should be all the 16 seeds in there instead of removing them. You had the opposite.
Yeah, I changed my mind. I don't like the fact that the 11 seeds get an advantage.
So
okay. TCU never stood a chance.
Do you just want to get rid of the first four? It doesn't seem
no, we
like
keep the
first.
I like the 16 seeds because then you can say we won a game in the tournament, because up until this year they weren't close to winning in the 16-1 games.
Well, what that would do is make the 2 seeds and the 3 seeds have a little bit tougher matchups, because you are eliminating more of the 16s before they get into the field of 64. Thus, you're probably going to have more seeding upsets.
But at least they're balanced seeding upsets. The 11 seeds right now, they have the advantage because you get an extra game.
Yeah, I'm going to sink because I just don't know who would want to watch 4 16 seeds battle each other. Like, that's a lot of matchups involving 16 seeds.
parents and alumni.
Like part of what drives it is you pair as a game of 16 seeds with a pair of, you know, more name brands like Michigan, who's been in it, or UCLA, or Syracuse, or somebody. You just put a bunch of 16 seeds, and did you watch the NEC tournament?
No.
Because that's basically what you're getting. You're getting more NEC games. Nah, man. Sink.
Bob?
I'm going to sink as well. A couple of things. The way we have it is basically a compromise. There was a group when they went to the 68 teams that wanted all four 16 teams like you are projecting, and then there was another group that wanted all of them to be the at-large teams. If you told me I had to have 68 teams in the tournament, I would go for all at-large teams. If you won your conference tournament, you're into the field and you don't have to play your way in. But I want to go back to 64. I want to eliminate the first four in Dayton, and I want to go back to 64 because it's perfect math. I will sink the idea of having the 11s all go into the field.
We'll stick it in the NCAA tournament. The Sweet 16 will begin tomorrow, and some teams have a slightly easier route than others, namely Kentucky, who doesn't need to face better than a 3 seed to get to the championship game, won't need to face better than a 7 to get to the Final Four, and that's why I believe the Sweet 16 should be reseeded once we get here. We have a week off, so teams won't lose any days because of travel, as like the first two rounds where they're back-to-back. And it's all about the matchups now. We've talked about this. Upsets lead to more interesting and maybe less blue blood matchups, like we have Nevada taking on Loyola Chicago. So, Bob, Swinker Sim, let's reseed the Sweet 16 once we get there.
I'm going to sink that as well. What made the NCAA tournament? It's the brackets. You wouldn't have brackets if you reseeded the 16. You'd have to have a new draw and do it from there. I don't think it's going to be as special as taking the whole thing and playing it out over 64. I also think that, you know, this is part of the lure of the tournament, the luck of the draw, how it comes out. Because if we were playing a series, a best of three, a best of five, best of seven, I don't think we'd have the same teams down to the Sweet 16 that we had based on the start on the one-game tournament. So I'm going to sink that as well. I think the brackets are too ingrained, and that's what has helped make the tournament be what it is.
Chris? I'm going to sink, too, because if you mess with the sanctity of the bracket, all of a sudden all you're seeing is average basketball. Like, really what makes this thing a thing is the bracket. Seeds, 1 through 16, the upsets, the unique paths. Because if you get rid of that, you're really just having a below-average basketball, at least compared to what college basketball used to be. I mean, it's not their fault, the one-and-done rule, and you know, nobody stays there anymore. So, yeah, you got to sink this, or else we would have college basketball turn into a disaster.
Well, since you guys like March Madness so much, how about this idea then? Of course, in the NBA, a lot of talk of tanking going on, teams benching players in order to get those precious lottery ping pong balls so they can get the number one overall draft pick. So let's instead create a March Madness style bracket for teams that miss the playoffs. Seed them 1 through 16. We'll play one and done style games. Winner gets the number one overall pick. Let's add some incentive and reason to watch late season basketball. Chris, sink or swim?
I'm going to sink because this doesn't work. This doesn't work because the players, they don't care.
Throw in some cash incentives, just like the NFL.
Okay, maybe if you start to throw in some cash or something.
Or you can opt out.
Like, the player, like, the number one pick is going to replace one of these players. Like, they don't want to go ahead and make it easier for them to be replaced and get less playing time next year. Like, what's in it for them? Like, if you guarantee more money or maybe their playoff position or something like that, then it incentivizes the player. But what's going to – the player isn't out here playing for next year's number one draft pick. That's not what's going to get
them motivated.
Unless
you're the ninth seed and you think you're one player away. Like, if the Sixers miss the playoffs, you don't think Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons will be motivated to get another one number one overall pick to help them?
No, I think they'd try to stay healthy for next year. You know, I don't want them to get hurt. You know, I don't think the current incentive structure is the worst thing in the world. Bad teams are going to be bad. Good teams and teams that are in contention are going to try to be good. The current incentive structure isn't as broken as people want to make it seem. And doing this, you're like Isaiah Thomas, for example. He's with the Lakers. He's right now their best player. The Lakers are playing pretty well. Isaiah Thomas is on a one-year deal. His deal expires after this. What incentive is he to try to get the Lakers the number one pick in the draft? Doesn't make any sense.
Give him some cash.
Sink.
Bob?
I'm going to sink. I really like Chris's thought on that if you get draft picks, better draft picks, that they will be basically playing for somebody that's probably going to steal their job. I think it would come up hokey. I'm not I don't know. I guess I'm not a big fan of the lottery either.
So how would you do it?
It's contrived. I think you'd have teams maybe that tank it. You know, to why would you want to be the eighth team in a conference? You're going to lose to the number one seed. Mm-hmm. If I had a decent team, a team that I thought might be able to contend for a six or a seven, I think I'd want to do just enough to get myself as the top seed playing for the first round in the lottery and then go win that. So
yeah.
I don't know how you do it. I mean, I don't think happenstance should give somebody a number one pick. And that, I don't know.
So
I don't know how you do it.
Worst team. Like the NFL. No lottery.
Well, yeah, I think so. But I think the league hasn't been honorable and people haven't tried to play. They've tried to skirt the issue, and it's not been a recent phenomenon. It's happened before because, in my opinion, one player can probably make a bigger deal in the NBA than any other sport. Have we ever had 3 for 3?
I mean, it just sank everything.
It's been a while. It was a rough return.
Yeah, that fish tank, man. You need to change the filter. Isn't that what happens? I never had a pet fish. Have you had a pet fish?
No,
before?
I've never had a pet
fish. I think the filter probably. We forgot to change the filter.
I was hyped up at the pet store. I had these teasers in the rundown, and I heard Chris say, I'm excited
I'm
for
excited
the
to sink them all. See, I was ready to sink every single one.
I was
one.
Lied to at the pet store.
There's the difference. I think this is how we attack the fish tank. Now, you've done this a lot longer because you guys used to do this in the morning. But I think the old glass is half empty, glass is half full. I think Chris looks to sink.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, Chris and looks to destroy.
I look to swim, but you gave me nothing that I could swim with today.
All right, we'll work on it. It's been, like I said, it's been a week off, or really a month off. We'll get back. We'll come back.
I think it's almost been a month off since we've done a fish tank. All right, March Madness is going to start up again tomorrow night here on Sports Radio The Ticket. You can tune in to 1350 a.m. tomorrow to get the beginning of the Loyola-Nevada game. That's at 5 o'clock. And then Friday, the early game is Clemson and Kansas. And then 93.1 FM will join in progress for the rest of the evening beginning at 6. And that's both tomorrow and Friday. March Madness on Sports Radio, The Ticket, again, tipping off tomorrow night, extending through the weekend. Up next in the update, what does Tony Romo have in common with UMBC? And I don't think it's that he owns a retriever, but maybe he does. That's next on Sports Radio, The Ticket.
Ticket Sports Update, sponsored by Wendy's. Wendy's serves fresh beef on every hamburger every day. Download the Wendy's app for offers you can't find anywhere else. Well, the Sweet 16 will start tomorrow. Nevada looking to make school history and advance to the Elite Eight for the first time ever. Today, the team had their press conference, and I talked to head coach Eric Musselman of the Wolfpack, who scored a game notoriety, and they asked him, who does Loyola Chicago, the Wolfpack's opponent in the Sweet 16, remind you most of? And he gave a sort of surprising answer when it came to comparing Loyola Chicago.
If I had to compare them to style and how difficult they are to prepare for, so like a St. Mary's team, for people on the West Coast. I mean, they're just they're so well coached, and they move the ball so well that they present problems for what type of defense you're going to game plan for them.
And tomorrow we will have Mike Burns, Boise State assistant, on to break down Loyola, who Boise State played, and Nevada, who Boise State played. So it'll be interesting. Coach faced them both. Give us positives, negatives for both, and give us a better idea of watching the game.
Yeah, it's a unique take for sure, and to be able to hear how a coach, not only that, but like how would you prepare? Like what do you do in these condensed, when you don't know the schedule, these are unfamiliar teams, and how exactly do you go about preparing to face them? You can't watch every game, at least I wouldn't think. So we'll get the answers to that. St. Mary's, how are they doing in the NIT, by the way?
They're alive.
They're still alive?
They won all home games.
All right.
I think the home team has only lost 2 or 3 games in the NIT.
Western Kentucky,
last year was 15-13. And Penn State's won 2 games on the road, and I think there's – and Western Kentucky. So 3 games heading into the last – couple to determine who's going to Madison Square Garden.
Now, St. Mary's, they'll host Utah next.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see.
Go with the home team.
Go with the home team. Because Washington was the team that beat Boise State, and St. Mary's ended up beating Washington.
Well, my big
West
team.
West Coast basketball.
I like rooting for friends as far as their teams. Their announcer are friends of mine. Good friend of mine is the announcer at Western Kentucky. He's never done a game at Madison Square Garden. He does the game tonight against Oklahoma State. If Western Kentucky can win on the road, he'll get to go to MSG, so I'm rooting for Western Kentucky.
Well, the most talked about quarterback battle this spring will have to wait a couple of days. Alabama started their spring ball yesterday, and sophomore standout Tua Tagovailoa, who Bob remembers quite well.
Yeah, I wonder why. How come he didn't get injured before the national championship?
Because Georgia didn't get any pressure on him.
Yeah.
Well, they did. They sacked him the play before he threw the touchdown. Yeah,
that's a very good point.
But unfortunately, he will miss the next couple days of practice. He injured his hand in the first day of spring ball, and this is what Nick Saban had to say about his quarterback battle.
Tua, you know, hurt his thumb today in practice, taking him to Birmingham to get that evaluated, but, you know, probably going to require some time for him to get back, and I don't want to speculate on what the injury might be, but most of the time when these type things happen, it takes a little while for him to come back. Well, I mean, Tua, obviously, I think in a few days, Tua will probably be able to do some things. But when you hurt your thumb on your throwing hand, it's kind of hard to grip the ball. So I think that's going to be the issue, is whether he's able to throw it. He and Jaden were splitting reps. And, you know, we're giving both guys an opportunity and see how they compete and see how they do. So we don't have any decisions. We're not speculating on any decisions. But we're just going to be fair and honest in terms of how we give both players a chance to compete.
So we'll see who eventually gets that job, whether they both stay with Alabama, whether they both evidently still play in games, whether he goes to a two-quarterback system. I think Alabama fascinating heading to the start of the season.
Just hearing Nick Saban's voice reminds me that, of course, he won the championship last year against Georgia. I was just wanting to bring that up once again.
I was not happy
against Georgia. But it also reminds me, okay, so Coach Saban win a championship this year in college football. Coach K is still alive in college basketball. His team right now is the betting favorite to win, although I still think Nova's the best team, but Duke is still more popular than Villanova, so if you wanted to go betting odds, I see why Duke is the favorite. So you could have Saban win that college football championship and Coach K win the college basketball championship. That's boring.
To me, Saban reminds me more of Calipari than Krzyzewski, because they both went to the pros and didn't do that well. They both have bounced around to more than one team, been successful at multiple teams. So when I think of Saban, if I'm going to draw a parallel, I'm going to draw it with Calipari before I do it with Krzyzewski.
They both hate the one-and-done rule. Oh, wait. I don't really know Nick Saban's opinion on the one-and-done rule.
There isn't one.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, people think like Coach Calipari like loves the one-and-done. He hates it. Like, he's more as critical of it as anybody else.
Well, I think that when you look at the people who've embraced it, I was surprised that Duke would embrace it, but I think they looked at it and these guys are competitive and decide that what's the best way to have the best team?
They have the best players. How do you get the best players? You get guys who only want to be in school until they can go into the NBA.
Right.
Well, speaking of Alabama and quarterbacks and battles, I think we need to have start a GoFundMe here on Sports Radio Ticket, because I think we need to send JP down to Alabama, because we need hard-hitting questions like this when it comes to the Alabama quarterback battle.
Pretty good relationship for two guys battling for playing time. How have you seen that relationship grow over the last few months?
Yeah, well, they're not battling, so there's no battling. I think we made that very clear.
There's no battle, Bob. You cannot use the word battle to describe what is going on at Boise State. Get it out of your minds.
There's not.
There's no battles in spring. There's no battles here.
That was question was asked in the fall. But did JP ask any of those real hard questions last week at the NCAA tournament?
No, he asked nothing about battling.
No. He needed to.
He should ask Calipari what it's like to battle.
Did he talk to Greg Oden? Greg Oden's had a lot of internal battles.
I don't think he didn't ask about Chris Webber about battling to call a timeout either. I mean, there was no battaling questions.
Ooh, did he bring up the timeout to Chris Webber?
No, he shouldn't have. Not on the air.
No. I'm about to say, that's another level.
Webber did go to Michigan, so as a Buckeye fan, I'm sure old JP might have thought about it just to rub it in.
I don't think Jalen Rose and Chris Webber get along, because Jalen Rose will sometimes bring up the timeout. Like, that's a thing, so...
Leave it to a Buckeye fan to rub it in a Wolverine's face. That's all I'll say. But you were talking about betting a little earlier, Chris, and Tony Romo set to make his PGA Tour debut this week as a sponsor exemption at the Corrales Punta Cana Resort and Club Championship. Sort of the B team at the PGAs. The top 50 guys are somewhere else. Romo's odds set at 2,000 to 1 to win the tournament. which, based on what I could find, are similar odds that UMBC had to win the NCAA tournament.
Well, they didn't win. I would have liked to know what they would have had to win the game.
Win the game, they were 2,000 on the money line, which money line is about, that's about 200 to 1 to win the game. So they were 200,000 to 1 to win the tournament.
I would think that, well, to win the tournament, I can't see Romo winning. I mean, not enough people are going to be that poor for him to come through. I would think that whatever odds, if you bet the field, if they gave you 2 cents on the dollar or something, I'd view it as interest. There's no way he could win the tournament.
Is Tony Romo, though, living his best life? Now, that is a real question. Like, speaking of battles, he doesn't have to battle these nagging back injuries anymore.
Or Dak Prescott.
Nor does he have to battle Dak Prescott, as you said. Nor does he have to battle his internal struggle with poetry. Because there was that whole poetry saga he had. I do not want to play quarterback. Dak Prescott is our quarterback. It was the weirdest thing. And now he's out here playing golf, talking to Jim Nance, and calling games. You're hearing Greg Olsen, isn't he considering retirement to call games?
Yeah.
And Joe Thomas, didn't he retire to call games? It seems a lot like playing football isn't very fun anymore. If you have the opportunity to be Tony Romo, it sounds like it's a much better option.
And he had the option. He had CBS and Fox both interested in hiring him, so he had multiple offers coming into it. Yeah, if you aren't loving playing football that much, you got an opportunity to do something else, why not?
Football hurts.
Unless you're Jay Cutler, then you turn down broadcasting to play football.
That's true. He kind of turned down football for broadcasting and then turned down broadcasting for football. In the meantime, he showed his bare butt on Instagram.
Yeah.
Do you think that Jay Cutler will be less coveted by TV?
Who was coveting Jay Cutler on TV other than Fox?
I never looked at him as somebody that I thought would go on TV. Would
Absolutely
you?
Not. Like, I didn't think of him as a guy who would show his bare butt out here on Instagram either, but he was doing that. So
I feel like if Jay Cutler could be Jay Cutler on TV, that'd be the greatest color commentary ever, because he would just be like, I could have made that throw. I don't know what that quarter. I could have made that throw. That's how he strikes me. I don't think he can do that professionally, though.
That got pretty far. They went to the practice reps and everything. Isn't Kevin Burkhart his partner with Charles Davis?
Yeah.
You posted a comment on the end of the TNT broadcast. Who was allegedly the play-by-play guy on that team?
Was it Greg Anthony? Might have been Greg Anthony. I don't even know. But if you want to go to my Twitter page, at Chris Lewis Tweet, and see what Bob's talking about, the players only is a thing that TNT does. This point of the year for some of their national TV broadcasts where they don't have a play-by-play announcer. They just have players do it. And it's the end of a close game between Oklahoma City and Boston. Two teams that
winning
are
winning shot.
Yeah, in the standings mix. Important game. Last possession down by two. Boston hits a game-winning three-pointer. They're literally stunned silent because they can't come up with the words to describe what's happening. And then when they go, as the ball's being moved, they're not talking. They're just on a roller coaster. And then when the shot goes, that's not broadcasting.
I didn't pick it as my quick hit because I thought for sure you were going
to
pick it.
I mean, what was I supposed to do? Play the audio?
Yeah, because we wouldn't know what was happening.
It was silence. I can't use that on the radio.
Yeah, you can.
All right, maybe time, I should have.
Time is money. You got the time. We've got the money. Your chance to win $1,000 four times a day is $4K a day on Sports Radio The Ticket. Up next, what did we learn in today's show about March Madness and Boise State football? That's next on Sports Radio The Ticket.
It's time to find out what we learned on Idaho Sports Talk with Bob and Chris. Brought to you by Purim Sports, full service pro shop, bowling specialist, high quality bowling balls, bags, and accessories located right inside West East Garden Lanes in Garden City. Talk about tournament coaches today. What makes a good tournament coach, and does that even exist? Got a text in the commercial tire text line for Postal Grandpa. Tournament coach is probably the wrong term. Some coaches are just better at adjusting both halftime and when games are close.
That's a really good point. And I think, even to that, if you really wanted to find out who's a good coach in college basketball, you'd have series in the postseason. Let's see which coach could actually come up with an adjustment from one game to the next and have a different strategy, morph your team into a different kind of style of play. And that would actually tell you who in college basketball can coach. And that's just a mass talent.
Mm-hmm. And I also think that, when you see what he's talking about, you see that during the course of the regular season. you know, different games, second half, coming back, doing better, maybe coming up with something different. Somebody, like, I'll remember the biggest adjustment I'll ever remember playing Temple when I was at UMass. John Chaney was the coach. It was the game he was suspended for. Remember when he had the kid from St. Joe's get attacked by one of his kids? So, start of the second half, UMass is up double digits. Temple goes man to man. UMass was not ready for that.
Yeah.
I don't think John Chaney would have ever gone man to man. Do you?
Mm-mm. That man to man, he's a 2-3 matchup zone guy, John Chaney. That's what he's all about. So, yeah, that's Boeheim. Would he ever go man? No. That's like 2-3 is what they do. So, it's how coaches adjust or something like that you would really learn, and you can navigate that or learn it throughout the season. And that's like the dilemma, if you will, of judging the coaching job based on 1 month. And, you know, that's the frustration behind the answer of Coach Leon Rice at the end of the Mountain West tournament game where the team lost. And he's like, well, maybe we overachieve and you can't define what happens or can't define our season based on what happens in March. Well, the truth is, in college basketball, it seems like that happens because this is when most of the media attention is paid for it or paid to it. But if you're really being realistic and looking at, yeah, college basketball is a 4-month season. November, December, January, February, then comes March. And how you do in those games, actually, you learn a lot more about whether a guy can coach or not based on how they navigate through that entire season. It's a shame that people don't really pay attention to it in that way, though.
And I think more people will value what happens, you know, now from the Sweet 16 on. I mean, I guess everybody's had relatively good seasons that's left. I mean,
yeah.
Loyola won their league. Nevada won their league. So you've got two teams that are well into 20 wins. So they've had good seasons. So it's not like they're not having they didn't have a good season and now do. So Jeff Cave's in studio. He and Mike Prater getting set to take over here on Idaho Sports Talk in a matter of minutes. Jeff, what do you guys have on your show today?
Well, we're going to go down, of course, the NCAA road with the coaches and their pressers today, the coaches that came through Boise at Nevada, Gonzaga, and Kentucky, and how they're getting ready for their Sweet 16 games. And we'll do that at 3 and 3:15. But 4 o'clock, we'll go into New Mexico, see how things wrapped up there, spring ball-wise, without Bob Davey. And then we'll follow up that with Kirk Craigthorpe, who's a columnist of the Salt Lake City Tribune, and he'll talk about a former Boise State recruit who may be starting at BYU when things are all said and done, plus give us an update on Tanner Mangum and how he's doing, sort of the forgotten man in the quarterback battle there at BYU.
Very good. I don't know, Jeff, if you saw that New Mexico, I guess, has got quite a few problems with the finances, that the school's trying to, or the athletic department wants them to forgive a pretty good amount of debt to just wipe out so that they can kind of start over with a new AD.
I didn't know that. I don't always know how that works. the state used to be involved quite heavily in that, the athletic department's finances. I remember they would ask the state government for a new scoreboard. I thought, well, that's pretty good. It's the furthest thing that would happen in the state of Idaho, given their limited resources here. But that's what they've done in New Mexico. So maybe there's a chance something like that would happen. I guess it's done all the time in other departments, so I don't know why it can't happen in athletics.
Well, it'll be interesting to find out what New Mexico got out of spring ball without their head coach, so and how what much he could be in contact, if at all, with the folks in Albuquerque.
Well, they got a new offense, so I'm interested to see how committed they are to spreading it around and throwing the football. Bob Davey did not think they were ready for that, and all the visits you and I had with them down there at the Mountain West Media Days in the summer, he'd said, no, that's just not, we're not there recruiting-wise, and here they go. Maybe this is the last gasp to try to get relevant.
Well, again, they won 3 games last year. He's got issues. They have to do something to look better, or I think that whole staff's going to be out.
So. Yeah, and looks like he is anyway. It doesn't, but stays in Phoenix or Scottsdale or something. I don't know how much time he spends in Albuquerque. So
we'll see.
It sounds like it's a meltdown as usual in New Mexico in football.
And more things change, the more things stay the same. So we got basketball coming up. New Mexico, I thought, did a much better job this year than I would have expected. They were a final team. They got to the, they got down into the championship game.
Well, this new offense thing means that it won't be the two options a year for Boise State to face anymore. The two like that's always been the
I think Air Force is going to stick
the
with
wrinkle
it.
In the schedule. The two options that you're guaranteed to face each year by being in the Mountain Division, and that changes up.
that certainly affects Boise State.
New Mexico, they thought good things, and they kind of fizzled last year, only 3 wins all season. So tomorrow, again, we'll get you ready for Nevada and Loyola. Mike Burns, Boise State assistant, is going to help us break down the matchup, and we'll get the flavor of the whole tournament with Jason Horowitz. Again, you can hear it all right here on Sports Radio The Ticket. Caves and Prater coming up next on Idaho Sports Talk as it continues from 3 until 6.
Sports Radio 93.1 FM and 1350 AM, The Ticket.